Welcome, everybody. This is the sixth and final class for the Mises Academy Basics of Economics, Government Intervention. Today is May 29th, 2014, and this final lecture is going to be on the boom-bust cycle. It also could be called Austrian business cycle theory, because that's what we're going to be talking about. Okay, let me first discuss the difference between what's often called microeconomics compared to macroeconomics. So if you take a standard college level course in economics, they'll have this dichotomy. And in fact, at the college level, will probably be broken up that you can either take a class in microeconomics or a class in macro. And so the sorts of things that you do in microeconomics are price theory for individual markets. And you can do things like rent control. You can do even like minimum wage law, stuff like that. You can do all sorts of things that seem to have big implications. But the point is you're looking at individual markets. So like the market for apartments or the market for low-skill labor. And so that's why all that stuff would fall under what's conventionally called microeconomics. So it doesn't just mean you're looking at a grocery store. It could be the national market for apples, or it could be the global oil market even, right? And you could be talking about OPEC's decisions on the price of crude oil, and what will that do? And oh, it'll have spillover effects, and it'll make the price of gasoline go up, and they'll make consumers do such. So you can do a lot of things that seem to have huge consequences, but the distinction between micro and macro typically is that micro looks at individual markets, and in particular, microeconomics is often what's called partial equilibrium analysis. I'm throwing out some big words here, but I just want you to understand, you probably heard this distinction before between micro and macro. And so what partial equilibrium analysis means is you hold a bunch of other stuff constant, in particular the prices of other things, and you just change one thing in the one market you're studying and then see how does that affect people. How do people react to that one change? All right. Whereas with macroeconomics, you're looking at all the markets together. You're looking at the economy as a whole, and you tend to focus on things like GDP and price inflation. I mean, they'll just call it inflation, but they mean price inflation, and unemployment. All right, so those are the sorts of things that macroeconomics typically looks at. And again, I'm talking about a standard course. Now, and then the analog of that partial equilibrium analysis is general equilibrium analysis, okay, where they allow for feedback effects. Okay, so that's the standard distinction you're going to get and normal mainstream economics between these two things. Okay, so all this stuff typically goes with micro, and all this stuff typically goes with macro. But the other thing you're going to get is that the technique will be different. All right, so it's not merely that the subject matter is different, but it's that the way the economists typically approach these two topics or these two fields is vastly different. So with micro, you're looking at things like individual consumers or individual businesses, and there's typically some optimization going on, right? The consumers see the price of gasoline, and then they decide how many gallons do I want to buy. That's how they build up the demand curve. All right, and the businesses say, oh, what are the prices of electricity and labor and so on, and then based on that, how many units of this product do I want to produce and sell? That's how you build up the supply curve. And then you put the two together, and that's how you figure out the market clearing price and quantity for that individual market. And so, yeah, they bring in mass and things like that, but it's still looking at individual decision makers and then figuring out how to changing signals from the marketplace in the form of prices, how does that affect the decisions that people then make? And that's kind of what you're studying in microeconomics. But with macro, the way it's typically done in mainstream college courses and mainstream textbooks and so on, it's a lot of times it's a completely different framework. Now, I don't want to say any more specifically about it. I'll just give you one example. And you don't need to know the example. I just want you to, I'm only giving this to you so you have an idea of what the heck is Murphy talking about. But you might see something like MV equals EQ, right? That's called the equation of exchange. And so that's something you might see to understand macroeconomics. And so what that is, just so you know what these letters mean, M is the quantity of money, V is the velocity of circulation, and so M times V is like saying how much total spending is there, right? Because M is how many dollar bills there are, and V is saying on average during a year, how many times does a dollar bill change hands? How many times does it turn over? So M times V then is going to give the total amount of dollars that turn over in a given time period, let's say a year. So that's the total spending that's going on. And then they say, oh, well, the total spending has to be equal to the total sales. And so that's P is the price level and Q is the quantity of output. So the average price times the total amount of sales or goods being sold, well, that's the total amount of purchases. Okay, and so that's why those two sides have to equal each other, and there you go. And so once you have that, now you think, oh, now we can manipulate this equation so we can see if M goes up on the left side over there, well, then if V stays the same, that means, you know, the right side has to go up. So either prices are going to go up or quantity is going to go up or some combination, right? And you start talking like that. Okay, so the point of me bringing this up is not – you don't need to know this equation of exchange. I want you to memorize that. I'm just trying to get you to see, notice how that is just methodologically totally different from what we've been doing in this course. But also, even if you took a regular college level course with a textbook talking about microeconomics and you learned how supply and demand curves work, where they come from, how do prices get formed in the gasoline market, or in the market for unskilled labor, and you understand how price controls can screw things up. Okay, you can learn all that stuff. But then they show you the equation of exchange. It's not taking that same toolbox and applying it to some different topic. It's a totally different set of tools. Okay, so that's what I'm trying to get you to see, is that mainstream economists use entirely different approaches when they look at what's typically classified under as microeconomics versus macro. Right? The Austrian school economists do not do that. The Austrian economists have always had a holistic view of economic science, where they say you use the same body of economic theory to explain all aspects of market phenomena. And so it was Mises in particular, one of his early contributions to economic science was to take what was called subjective value theory that Carl Menger developed, that economists were now comfortable using to explain barter prices, what we did in this course, if you were with me, back when we were doing the candy bar example. Okay, so there we were figuring out how do exchange rates emerge in a market where there's no money, where people just have goods and they have different preferences and different initial holdings, and then how did they trade with each other and everyone walks away better off? And how do we as economists say true statements about what those equilibrium prices are going to be? So that's kind of thing Menger developed. But then economists were still using something like this equation of exchange to talk about the macro economy, to talk about prices in general. And Mises was, one of his contributions was to provide a fully satisfactory explanation of even money prices using the same theoretical framework that Menger had developed and that economists were comfortable using in situations of barter. So why I'm dwelling on this is I want you to see that this dichotomy between micro and macro doesn't really hold in the hands of the Austrians. That, yes, the Austrians have something to say about the growth of total output, although they're very hesitant to use terms like GDP because it aggregates a bunch of things together. You kind of lose a lot of information that way. It's inaccurate or misleading. But Austrians certainly can explain the German hyperinflation or the Zimbabwean hyperinflation. The Austrians know what caused it. They can explain it. The Austrians know what caused those unemployment. It's not just like, oh yeah, a particular restaurant failed and so all those employees got laid off. That is different from, geez, unemployment was 25% in the worst year of the Great Depression. You know, something's, it seems like something else is going on there. The Austrians are able to explain that. But my point is they do not use a different set of tools. They use the same type of analysis. They always ground their explanation in individual choices and preferences. However, one last thing is the reason we had to defer this particular topic until the end is that we're going to be drawing on all the stuff we've developed up till now. So there are a lot of to fully understand the explanation of the boom-bust cycle that Ludwig von Mises and Friedrich Hayek developed, you need to have the elements that we already have in place now and the other stuff we've done so far. Okay, let me give you the conventional view of the business cycle. All right, so the so-called normal business cycle, people often think, even fans of the free market, by the way, will say, oh yeah, it's normal for there to be a business cycle. That's just capitalism at work. That there's these boom periods where there's an upswing, businesses are optimistic, they hire, they start investing and expanding their capacity, trying to develop new markets for their product, bringing out new product lines and so on. Hiring workers, the workers see their wages getting bid up, they have a lot more options, people giving them job offers, they go out, they're spending more, consuming more, times are good, and it's just this general upswing, this general prosperity. Everybody's happy. Unemployment's really low. GDP growth is unusually high. But, alas, that always seems to come crashing down, and then businesses lay off workers, they realize they were expanding too quickly, and it's a vicious downward spiral. Because now the laid off workers obviously don't have paychecks, and even the people who keep their jobs are now real skittish because they see the economy's bad, and so they clam up and they start saving more out of their paycheck. But oh geez, if the workers aren't spending their paychecks, then that means businesses are seeing their sales plummet, and so it's a vicious downward spiral. And so the idea is the normal business cycle. Okay, let's do this. So normally it might look like this. And then the idea is, what if the government could come in and engage in what's called counter-cyclical policy? So instead of having these wild up and down swings, so you know this is time going this way and this is like GDP. Instead of having the economy go like that, so it's definitely growing, you know, there's a trend line. the economy still grows over the decade, but the point is under the market economy, it's wild up and down. And so the idea is instead of doing that, maybe we could smooth it out. So maybe instead we can make it look like this. All right, so you see how I drew that line going through on the same, so it's the same trend line, but it's tighter. It doesn't oscillate as high or as low as the laissez-faire free market would. All right, so that is the conventional view which I've just gone over. And then let me give you some specifics about what counter-cyclical policy would be. One example would be what's called graduated income tax or tax bracket in general, income tax in particular. And so graduated, another term that's called progressive. So what that means is it's not a flat tax, but it's that the higher your income, the greater the percentage that you get taxed. So you get pushed into, so there's higher tax brackets. That's the idea. So why would that be part of counter-cyclical macro policy? And again, just so no one gets lost, I'm here giving you guys a conventional view. So I think this stuff is all crazy, but I want you to understand what these terms mean and how a middle-of-the-road normal economist probably would describe this if you grabbed them off the street and told them, hey, explain this to my mom. This is probably how the person would do it. Okay, so graduated tax brackets, besides perhaps being considered fair, but oh yeah, if you make more money, you ought to pay more in taxes, even a higher percentage, let alone a higher dollar amount. What does that have to do with counter-cyclical policy? Well, because they're going to say, really what you would like to have, if you're from what's called a Keynesian perspective, let me just type that out for, I'm sure most of you know what this term means, but in case some of you don't. Keynesian. So that's named after John Maynard Keynes. So from the Keynesian point of view, the reason you get these wild up and down swings that we talked about over here is because of aggregate demand fluctuating wildly. And so the Keynesian solution is in times when the market economy left to its own devices would see spending plummet, you want the government and or the Fed to come in and enact policies that do the opposite, right? So that when aggregate demand from the market would be falling, you want the government to come in and have its spending go up and also enact policies that give a kickstart to private spending. And then vice versa, if the economy's booming too much, you want, if it's overheating, you want the government and the Fed to enact policies to cool off the spending. All right, so that's what counter-cyclical policy does. It's called leaning into the wind. So graduated tax brackets, coming back to that point finally, how does that serve this purpose? Well, the idea is in boom times, when everyone's income's rising and spending is rising too quickly, well, that's going to automatically knock people into higher tax brackets. So the government's going to tax away more of their income. So now they're left with less to spend after tax. So that automatically knocks them down. So the idea is if the government could just change policies on a dime, well, then when the Keynesian economists, you know, saw that the economy was in a boom, they would raise taxes. And then when the economy was in a slump, they would want to cut taxes. But it takes time to do that, right? You have to push through legislative changes to the tax code. The president has to approve it. And you have to recognize what state the economy is in. And sometimes if the data lags, you don't even know until you're 6 months into a recession, that kind of thing. So that's why Keynesians like these counter-cyclical policies like graduated income tax brackets, because that's already in place. And it's automatic. That automatically, even before the economists might realize that we're in a dangerous upswing, if we are in an upswing, well, then everyone's getting pushed in a higher tax bracket. And so that's an automatic tax increase. And vice versa, as the economy plummets down into a recession, people's incomes are dropping, and so they're going to be taxed at a lower rate. So it's an effective tax cut to the people who are seeing a deteriorating economic position. Okay, so that's the idea. So it's doing exactly what the Keynesians want in real time without having to wait for the government to recognize the problem and then legislatively respond. Other so-called automatic stabilizers are things like food stamps and unemployment benefits. Because again, ideally, the Keynesian would want the government to stimulate spending when the economy's in a slump. And so to have these programs in place that automatically allow people when they get when they need assistance to get money from the government so they can go spend it. Well, that's exactly what you'd want from a Keynesian perspective. And you don't have to go and vote on these packages every time there's a recession. They're already up and running. It's just default things that happen automatically. Okay, and then another big one that I somehow failed to put in here is just the is monetary policy. So the conventional view here, how do you do countercyclical monetary policy is, well, when the economy is overheating, price inflation is too high, unemployment is very low, that means that the Fed's pumping in too much money. So it should raise interest rates, slow the rate of monetary inflation, and then that will get the higher interest rates will cause businesses and consumers to spend less. And then vice versa, if the economy is going into a slump and you see unemployment getting too high, the standard Keynesian solution is, oh, the monetary authority needs to engage in looser policy. They need to cut interest rates, which involves flooding the market with new money. And that pushes down interest rates. And that the lower interest rates stimulate private investment and consumption spending. Okay, so that's, in broad strokes, the conventional view of macroeconomic countercyclical policies. And again, the idea is left to its own devices, the market economy is really volatile. And you might even hear people say stuff like, hey, we tried laissez-faire in the 1920s, and look what happened. We got the Great Depression. And so that's why we learned our lesson, and we now have a much more activist central bank. The federal government put in place all kinds of automatic stabilizer programs. And hey, we haven't had a Great Depression since. And you could point to the crisis since 2008, and they'd say, yeah, exactly. Had we not had all these measures in place, had Bernanke not done all that crazy stuff, all the massive stuff, they wouldn't call it crazy, had Obama not run the huge $1 trillion plus deficits, then we would have had a repeat of the Great Depression. But we didn't, because thank goodness they had all those countercyclical policies in place this time around. Right? That's the standard spiel you'll get. Okay. You're not going to be surprised to learn that I, as well as the typical Austrian economist, disagree totally with all of that. That in fact, it's precisely the government's role in money and banking that causes the so-called normal or natural business cycle. That's actually not something inherent to laissez-faire capitalism. Rather, that's due to government intervention, specifically government intervention, as I say, in money and banking. So this is, notice the pattern here. This is the same kind of thing we've talked about in other arenas where, oh, you want to help poor people afford an apartment, and so you put in place rent control. But far from helping poor people, that actually makes it hard for many of them to even get housing in the first place. And then if they do get it, if the rent control has been in force for several years, the landlord they deal with is not going to be a nice guy, depending on the area and how severe the rent control is. It's going to be a so-called slumlord, and the building might be in really bad physical disrepair because of the incentives put in place by rent control. And yet the average person looking at that is going to say, oh man, that's the market economy just failing to provide adequate shelter for these poor people. That's really just, you know, capitalism's good for the rich, but it can't really house the poor. And you would be looking at the effects of government intervention and blaming it on the market. So same thing here. One of the biggest complaints against capitalism is the ravages of the boom-bust cycle. And in particular, people will look at the Great Depression and think that's what laissez-faire capitalism gets you. And no, the exact opposite. Okay. In order, though, for you to understand what I'm going to walk through the remainder of this course or this class, I just want to emphasize up front, it's the Austrian economists really are the only ones who can give an explanation of this type, because they stress what's called capital theory. So we've been actually doing that in this course, even though I haven't been harping on it and been putting a label on it. But if you've been reading the textbook and have taken these courses in the earlier sequence, the part about Robinson Crusoe being on the island and how does he raise his standard of living while he has to defer consumption and invest in the production of more capital goods. And that's how he eventually grows over time. And then we elaborated upon that and expanded it in the case of Frugal Freddy and Prodigal Paul, and showed how, you know, what's actually going on physically if one person saves a lot over the course of decades. How is it possible physically that person then can consume more in the retirement years? And we walked through that and talked about that. All right, so that is part of what's called capital theory. So those things are called capital goods. It's, you know, there's land, labor, and capital goods. Land is natural resource, and labor, of course, is human effort, the output of human bodies. And then capital goods are factors of production that have been produced by humans. So tools, factories, equipment, machinery, that sort of thing. It can also be unfinished goods, goods that are in packages in the warehouse. That those are all examples of capital goods as opposed to consumer goods. Okay, so the Austrians, more than any other school, have a richly developed theory of capital goods and how does that fit into overall what's called structural production. So I'm here on this slide, it's guys like Mises and Hayek who really stress capital goods. I didn't put his picture up here, but this guy, von Bavert, who was Mises' predecessor, also was really a giant in this area. In contrast, these guys over here, so you probably know Paul Krugman, this is Thomas Piketty, and this is Robert Solow. They think of capital as just a number. And so they understand that the more capital an economy has, the more it can produce, but they don't look at capital as a collection of different or heterogeneous goods. They just look at capital as, hey, what's K? What's the capital stock? The Austrians, in contrast, recognize and take account of the fact that capital goods are different. That let me just give you an example. It makes a difference. Hammers and nails are both examples of capital goods. You can produce more stuff if you have more hammers and nails, right? Labor, just with its bare hand, can't produce very much. But if workers now have hammers and nails, they can do a lot more than if they don't have those things. All right? But if you just come up with a system of weighting, and so you say, oh, well, one hammer is the same as 100 nails. And so I'm going to just aggregate and come up with a total number for how many hammers and nails we have. And so we've got 1,000. You say, but what does that mean? Does that mean that, you know, you have 10 hammers and the rest nails, and the way you're adding them up is that with that weighting, that one hammer is a certain number of nails, and so you weight it that way. Or it could be something else, right? You could have all nails, or you could have all hammers, or you could have a bunch of hammers and just a few nails, right? So there's different combinations of actual hammers and nails that would give you that same number of, or that same total, once I gave you the rule for how do you add hammers and nails together in the common denominator. So clearly in the real world, if you have people working on a project, it would make a difference to them. It wouldn't be enough information just to say, oh, give them 1,000 units of hammers and nails. They would need them in a precise ratio. They would need a certain number of hammers and a bunch of nails. They would want a lot more nails than hammers. Okay, so that's just one example. Or if you think of agriculture, capital goods in agriculture are things like tractors, but also fertilizer. Right, bags of fertilizer that you get from a producer that have been cultivated and so on, put in nice bags for dispensing, that's a capital good. And so you might come up with a weighting mechanism and say one tractor is worth 100 bags of fertilizer, okay? But then to say how much capital does that farm have, and if the answer is 1,000, well, it makes a difference. Does that, you know, one tractor and what, 900 bags of fertilizer? Or is it 10 tractors and 0 bags of fertilizer? Both would still be 1,000 if you're using 1,000 bags of fertilizer, but obviously you would probably want something in between those two. Okay, you certainly wouldn't just want 1,000 bags of fertilizer and 0 tractors, but you also probably wouldn't want 10 tractors and no fertilizer. Okay, so again, it makes a difference, the specific composition of the capital goods. And I feel funny even mentioning this because you're probably, well, who doesn't know that? And yeah, if you ask Paul Krugman, does it matter what the composition of capital goods are? Would we be fine if the whole economy just all of a sudden had nothing but hammers? Of course, Paul Krugman, we hope, would say, yeah, that would be bad. If tomorrow we woke up and the economy had nothing but hammers, that would be bad. But yet in his model, capital is just K. It's just a single number encompassing all the capital in the economy that's been condensed and aggregated into a single number with some weighting mechanism based on price. And so the kind of stuff we're going to talk about here, the Austrian explanation of what is it that goes wrong during the boom period that then sets us up for an inevitable crash, you can't even tell that story without making this distinction that I just spent the last 5 minutes going over, the importance of capital theory. I learned that when I was at NYU. I was talking when I was a grad student, and I was talking to some of my fellow students. We're all getting our PhD in economics, and they knew I was in this thing called Austrian economics, and so I told them the story, the guy said, "Oh, so it's an overinvestment story." And I had to say, "No, it's a malinvestment story." We'll come back to that point later. But again, the problem was that guy was thinking of it in terms of what's called a solo growth model this guy developed. And in that kind of model, the only thing that can go wrong is if you save too much and invest too much, then that means people are sad because they've accumulated too much equipment when really they would have preferred to eat more. But it's not like they built up the wrong type of equipment, because there's only one kind of equipment you can make in the simplified model that this guy built. All right, and so you can't even tell the Austrian story in that kind of a framework. So that's part of the issue there. Okay, related to the importance of capital theory, and I'm telling you these things up front because I'm afraid if I get it, once I start getting into the story, if I then near the end try to lay the important ideas on you, you're already going to be fatigued. So that's why I'm telling you up front the stuff to be looking out for. what drives the Austrian story is this notion of capital consumption. So you could, a literal example is what's called eating the seed corn. All right, so that's an agricultural example of it. So what does that mean? Where does that term come in? And then the phrase has been generalized. So now if someone says, oh, he's eating the seed corn, it doesn't necessarily literally mean there's a farmer out there who's eating the seed corn. It could mean it's a metaphor for capital consumption. But in its literal sense, what does that mean, in case you've never heard that term before? Well, if you're a farmer and you're raising corn, growing corn, well, every harvest, you get some of the corn, and then you're supposed to save the seed corn because that's what you need to plant for the next harvest. And so if you were, for some reason, were really hungry or you lost a bunch of the other corn or whatever, you could eat the seed corn, and that would allow you to eat more corn this year. But why would that be a bad idea? Well, why in general would you want to be really careful about doing that? Well, because obviously if you eat the seed corn, then that means you can't keep the cycle of production going. In a limit, if you ate all the seed corn, so you had nothing to plant, well, then you would have nothing. That would be it. You'd be out of corn then for the rest of your life. Unless you got seeds from somewhere else. Okay, so that's the idea. So that's the metaphor. So the idea is eating the seed corn allows you to consume more today, but at the expense of ruining or permanently lowering your future harvest. So that idea generalizes. So in general, eating the seed corn means you're doing something that in the short term is enjoyable, but has disastrous long-term consequences. So another example I like to give is imagine that you're the owner of a fleet of trucks that ship cargo around. Okay, so you own, let's say, 100 trucks, tractor trailers, and you have the trailer on the back, and you just ship stuff around. So your customers are people that need to move a bunch of cargo from point A to point B over the interstate highway system. And so that's why they're calling you. And you rent out the services of your truck, or they just pay you a flat fee to move the stuff from whatever, Cincinnati to Brooklyn, who knows what. Okay, so you got a fleet, let's say, of 100 trucks, and that's your business. They're on the move. At any given time, you're going to need to have those trucks, some of those trucks, being serviced. All right, I'm just making this number up. I have no idea what in the real world the proportion is. But let's say at any given time, you have 5% of your trucks being serviced. All right, that at any given time, 5 out of your 100 fleet or your 100 truck fleet, 5 of the trucks are actually in the service bay, getting their tires rotated, getting the brakes checked, getting the oil changed, getting into whatever. Okay, there's routine maintenance that you need to do on your trucks. And again, I'm just making it up. Let's say the optimal thing to do to keep your fleet in good working order is that at any given time, about 5% of them are getting serviced. So at any given time, in normal circumstances, you only got 95 trucks out on the highways driving, delivering cargo. So that's how you make your money, of course. Nobody's paying you to have trucks in the shop getting the oil changed. In fact, that costs you more. But the reason you do it is for the long-term reliability of your fleet. You can keep your vehicles in operation longer so they can do more jobs and bring in more revenue. And it's worth it to periodically take each truck out of the rotation and get it serviced. Okay, now let's just say for whatever reason on a particular month, business is booming. And you have all of these major clients calling you up saying, I have an emergency order. I was going to ship this by rail, but there was a derailment or something, and now that's all messed up. The train tracks coming into our city are all closed for the next 2 weeks because there was a chemical spill. I got to get this product in here, and so I'm going to need to use trucks. And so, what, you know, I'll pay you double the normal rate, but you got to help me here. So what are you going to do? Well, you're going to say, I can temporarily use all 100 trucks. Or, in other words, I'm going to postpone the oil change and the tire rotation that units 85 through 90 were normally supposed to get because of this lucrative opportunity. So you have that flexibility, you can do that. And so that's going to give a short-term appearance of great prosperity. And in terms of your accountant's doing the book, he's going to say, whoa, you had a great month. You brought in a lot more revenue than you normally do, and your expenses were lower because you weren't paying the mechanics to change the oil, and you weren't paying for new tires and that kind of stuff. So that's great, but what if you kept doing that? What if you said, well, geez, that was good. Why don't I just keep doing that? And we'll always have all 100 vehicles out on the highway delivering product, and I'll never – you know, this is why that's just money out the door. I'm paying the mechanics to change the oil. That's stupid. That's costing me money. Why am I doing that? All right. And so for a while, that would look profitable. But of course, that would be foolish. Really, you would be destroying your business doing that because eventually you're going to have a truck on the road that the tire is going to blow out, or even worse, you know, the engine's going to seize up or something because you didn't change the oil, or the oil ran out of oil or something. Okay, so the point is, by deferring or not doing those routine maintenance operations, you're actually destroying the capital structure of your business. It's the analog of Crusoe not maintaining his poles, right? Just to keep using, remember we were saying that original story early in the textbook, that to indefinitely keep his production at that higher level, Crusoe needed to maintain his capital stock. All right, so the point is, in the short term, if you stop doing that and effectively consume your capital, then you can have this appearance of prosperity. So that's what the Austrian story fundamentally is that we're going to see, because of government intervention, business people get the wrong signals, the wrong guidance, and they end up doing the wrong thing. And in the aggregate, stepping back and looking at what's going on, society consumes its capital. So it's not, I mean, literally, you can eat the seed corn, you can literally do it there, but here, it's not that the business owner is going out and gnawing on his tires. No, what he's doing, if he just keeps postponing the maintenance and then taking the profits out of his business and going out to fancy restaurants and so on, buying sports cars, saying, hey, my business is booming, this is great. If he's doing that, he's also consuming capital, not in a literal sense. He's not eating his engines. But the point is, he's using revenue derived from his failure to maintain the engine in order to boost his consumption. So metaphorically, he's consuming his capital. All right. And so the idea is, that's what lots of people are doing during an unsustainable boom. Okay, I think the best way to walk through this is to follow Friedrich Hayek's advice. Because before we can even ask how things might go wrong, we must first explain how they could ever go right. So in this context, to understand how is it that the wrong signals that are ultimately there because of government intervention in the monetary and banking arenas, how is it that those wrong signals end up leading to that capital consumption we just talked about? It's first, let's talk about the right signals. Let's look at when things go correctly in a market economy. All right, so let me just, when we're talking about a savings-induced expansion. So what that means is, we're talking about a case where the economy grows over time, where the flow of real goods and services, the amount of stuff that the economy produces and the people get to enjoy, that grows over time and it's sustainable. So how does that happen? So I'm going to just make a couple points here. So first is that growth isn't just about technological discoveries. Also, it's due to saving and investment. Okay, so we all recognize that we today have a higher standard of living than people 100 years ago. And the people 100 years ago had a higher standard of living than people 100 years before that. And so if you study economics, you know one way of describing that is to say that the productivity of labor has gone up. That to understand how can it be that people today have a higher standard, a material standard of living? Well, it's that we can produce more stuff with an hour of labor. And that's how we can consume so much more. Our houses are nicer, cars are better, we have more food, and we don't have to work as much. So we have more leisure also. So how is that technologically possible, physically possible? Well, it's because the productivity of labor is higher. For a given hour of work, effort, you can produce more food or more clothes or more radios, what have you. So a lot of people at this point would say, oh, so the explanation, the reason we can produce so much more today than 100 years ago, they could do so much more than 100 years before then, is technological advances or discoveries. That scientists went out there and found stuff, or inventors just created new ideas, and we figured out better ways of doing stuff. And that's why now we produce more per hour of labor. That's certainly part of it, but it's not the only part. Another main thing is that there has been saving and investment. And so we have more capital goods to augment our labor today than people had 100 years ago. So it's not just that our forefathers have passed down their intellectual discoveries. They've also bequeathed a bunch of equipment, or they've bequeathed land that they transformed. You know, if they built a canal that greatly reduced shipping time, well, that's part of what we inherited. That they were the ones who spent all the resources creating the canal, and now we get to enjoy the fact that we can get cargo from point A to point B with a lot less time and fuel used and stuff like that. Okay? The railroads that were built, the highways, and so on and so forth, all the fleet of airplanes. We inherited all that stuff, all the factories, the tools inside the factories. Another way of seeing this is, suppose you had a cruise ship full of surgeons, engineers, mathematicians, physicists, electrical engineers, architects, the cream of the crop. And then that cruise ship crashed and everyone had to swim ashore, and they were on this deserted tropical island like Gilligan's Island, and they had no tools or equipment. Their standard of living would drop pretty drastically, even though mentally they know the cutting edge approaches in all the leading fields of, you know, medicine and science and so on, because they don't have the tools to work with. They would have to start at a pretty primitive level and start building up from scratch. All right, so the reason we have such a higher standard of living today compared to 100 years ago is not merely that smart people have discovered new technological recipes. It's also because people have been saving and accumulating capital goods. Okay, so a savings-induced expansion, what happens? People become more patient, meaning they save more out of their income. That extra saving enters the financial system and pushes down interest rates. And then low interest rates act as a green light to invest more. All right, so that's the basic story. This is how an economy expands and grows over time in a sustainable fashion. This is when interest rates do the correct thing, when they give the right signals. Okay? In the interest of brevity, I don't want to overload you and make this too complicated. I'm not going to dwell on this too much. I'm just giving you the broad strokes, but that's the idea. And so with Crusoe, with one person on an island, all of this stuff happens. It's all contained within house. The Crusoe saves, meaning he consumes less than he would be able to if he wanted to just do nothing but consume. And then he also invests. He takes his saved resources and invests it in the production of the pole or the net or whatever, the canoe. In a modern economy, those functions get dispersed. So certain households can save, but they're not the ones actually deciding what capital goods are going to be produced instead. That decision gets made by somebody else. So you've got households deciding, hey, we want to save up more because we want to take a cruise in 20 years. We're going to go on that European cruise when we retire, and so we're going to put aside money every year. And so how are we going to do that? Well, we're going to not go out to eat as much, or we were going to buy an extra pair of fancy shoes for going out in the town. We're not going to make that purchase. Okay, so the households are becoming more patient, meaning they're deferring their consumption. Instead of spending on stuff that gives enjoyment today, they're saying, no, let's save more today for the next 20 years so that down the road we'll then get to enjoy a much better vacation than if we don't save. So all along, what's happening, they're consuming less. So the economy's actual resources that otherwise would have been going into producing more meals at restaurants and more fancy shoes and the other sorts of things that the people might have been consuming, now those resources are freed up. And it might look bad, right? The restaurant that sees its sales drop 10% because the household are saving more and they're going out to eat less, that restaurant owner might be upset and say, oh, this is bad. This is bad news. I don't like this saving. And he has to lay off workers and, you know, reduce their shifts, and maybe he doesn't open up a new location because business is down. But those workers aren't lost to the economy. They can get reabsorbed elsewhere. So the point is, the household doing the saving, they don't also have to determine, okay, instead of the workers now going to the restaurant where we used to go every day, now since we're cutting back, they're going to lay that person off. Where should that worker go now in the economy? The households who are trying to save more, they don't need to make that decision. The market, through its price signals, guide that worker to say, here's where you ought to go. Just like in general, the price system through the profit and loss test gives signals and guidance to people. That there's no one person who surveys the whole economy and says, with these resources and with these desires among the population, here's the master plan of what we will produce. There's nobody doing that, or even there's not even a group of people doing that in a market economy. That's not how it works. So by the same token, if a bunch of households start saving more because they want to consume 20 years from now, the market can handle that, but it's through a decentralized mechanism with shared decision making. if you want to think of it that way. And so specifically, when the households save more, they go, they put more money in the bank, they go, they buy more bonds from companies, maybe they buy more stocks, who knows what. But they save in various ways, and then you could say they invest in financial assets if you want. But then ultimately there are entrepreneurs running businesses who now see interest rates fall. And with that lower interest rate is a signal of, oh, it's cheaper now to borrow financial capital, meaning it's cheaper for you to go and invest in the expansion of your business, for example. Okay, so that's the mechanism. So it's the extra savings enters the financial system, the supply of loanable funds shift to the right, if you want to think like that, and that pushes down the equilibrium interest rate. And so now it's cheaper to borrow. Businesses are going to engage in longer term projects. Why would they engage in longer term projects? Well, I don't want to make this too complicated, but in terms of the accounting, if you have a project that requires a bunch of upfront spending, investment, and then it will yield you a flow of net income, you need to use what's called a discount rate to compare the upfront spending now to the flow of income. Like, let's say you're thinking about building an apartment complex, and maybe it takes you, it's like $1 million for you to build the thing, and then you're going to rent it out to tenants and maybe earn a flow of $100,000 of net income every year once this thing is up and running. Should you do it? Well, you need to know what the interest rate is, because you're effectively going to be earning 10% annually on your investment, right? You spend $1 million up front to build the apartment complex, and then you're going to get an annual flow of $100,000 in net income. That, you know, the tenants are going to pay you enough in rent such that after you pay your expenses, including the maintenance on the building, you have $100,000 left over year after year. That's the scenario. So is that a good investment? Should you do that? Again, you need to know what the interest rate is. That's a crucial part of that calculation, because you're effectively earning 10% on your money. So if bonds, if really safe corporate bonds, AAA bonds, are paying 12%, well, you would be stupid to invest in that risky apartment project, because you can make 12% on your money in bonds. You take that $1 million, buy bonds, and then get paid $120,000 year after year, assuming you thought you could keep rolling the bonds over at 12%. All right. In contrast, if bonds are only paying 2%, well, now maybe you do want to go into that apartment project. Okay, so see there how if interest rates drop, a given project that, you know, you've made your estimate about how much money you have to spend to get it up and running, and then your estimate about the net income it's going to yield you over time. As interest rates drop, that makes you more and more likely to go ahead and invest in that long-term project. Okay, so, and that's what you want. That's, if the interest rate is correct, that's exactly what you want to have happen. As society becomes more patient and willing to defer consumption, then you want entrepreneurs investing in longer and longer projects that require resources to be put into them today, but then down the road will yield their fruits, metaphorically. Okay, so that's fine. That's what you want, everybody. That's what you want entrepreneurs doing. That's if the interest rate's doing its job. Okay, so that's the standard. That's how things will go correctly. And so just to finish that story, the households are all saving more. Interest rates drop. The entrepreneurs get the green light. They invest in longer-term projects. And so now, 20 years from now, the workers and everybody have more tools to work with. And there were projects that were put in motion that yield their higher output down the road. And so it all dovetails. And so the households that saved for 20 years now think they have a bunch of extra financial assets, and they go and spend them down, and yep, the economy is physically able to produce a bunch of stuff to satisfy that. And again, I'm dumbing this down a little bit, but that's the basic idea. Okay. What about a credit-induced expansion? So what if, instead of that story I just told you, What if instead we're looking at the same market for loanable funds and the savings increases, right? There's a bunch of new money that comes on the market that's willing to be lent out, but the source is not from households restricting their consumption, and that's where the savings come from. No, in this case, what if this savings is actually coming from the central bank creating new money? Or if you want to get more sophisticated, the commercial banking system creating new loans because of what's called fractional reserve bank. But if that's confusing to you, don't worry. Just for right now, just think of it as the Fed running off $100 bills and then entering the loan market and making loans. Well, the supply curve is still going to shift to the right because of that Fed inflation, and that's going to make the market clearing rate of interest drop. Because remember, it's both a blessing and a curse of a decentralized market mechanism, is when you distribute that decision-making around, nobody, no one person surveys the whole system. And so that allows for the power of the market economy where it can harness all of the dispersed information in the way that Hayek thought about it. And so the economy can quickly adapt to new situations. But the problem is, if those signals are wrong, well, then people end up making the wrong decision because they're getting guided improperly. And so that will still give a green light to the entrepreneurs. They will still engage in long-term investment projects, but that savings is phony. It's not genuine savings that's coming from households restricting consumption. Instead, it's coming from the central bank just creating that money out of thin air. So the problem here is it's physically unsustainable. The reason the savings-induced expansion was sustainable and it all dovetailed and made sense was that, remember, the households actually restricted their consumption. And so the firms in the economy that had previously been catering to their short-term enjoyments saw their sales go down. So they had to lay off workers. They stopped buying so many raw materials. So that freed up labor and other resources that then the longer-term capital goods-producing industries could absorb. So the economy just rebalanced and shifted the composition of what it was producing. In contrast, when there's a credit-induced expansion, everybody's trying to expand at the same time. The entrepreneurs see the lower interest rate, and they're trying to borrow more and expand their operations, but consumers are going out to the movie theater more. They're going out to fancy dinners more. They're buying shoes and other designer clothes and sports cars because they didn't want to save more. They didn't become more patient. Their preferences didn't change, and now all of a sudden interest rates are low. So it's cheaper to live it up in the present. So that's why it's unsustainable. Because there's not the central bank's decision to print more money did not create more farmland or create more drill presses or 18-wheelers. It didn't make the scientists smarter. It didn't make the engineers have more skills. It didn't make workers more productive. It just created a bunch of money. And yet it gave the green light, and so the entrepreneurs are acting as if there's more genuine savings available to fund or to carry through the completion of these long-term projects. But those genuine savings are not actually available. In fact, the opposite, consumers are saving less than they were before because interest rates have been pushed down. Okay, so that's the fundamental problem, is that interest rates are falling even though savings hasn't actually increased. And so that's going to make businesses respond in a certain way that's incompatible with how households are responding. So the tragedy in all this is that it's not just an immediate incompatibility that then just stopped dead in its tracks. The tragedy is that this can last for years, this unsustainable boom, as long as the central bank keeps upping the ante and pumping in ever greater amounts of money to keep interest rates artificially low, it can keep the boom going. And how is that possible? How can it be if there's not more physical stuff, if the amount of resources hasn't magically been increased, and if technology hasn't increased or improved, how can the central bank keep this boom going? It's because of capital consumption. The consumers aren't wrong. They really are going out to dinner more and seeing more movies and buying more shoes and things like that. And the businesses really are building bigger factories and, you know, laying the groundwork, and they think, yep, everything's on schedule, we're expanding. But the problem is they're consuming capital, the system as a whole is, at least. But it's unwitting. They don't realize they're doing it. So consuming capital is not necessarily a bad thing. You can come up with scenarios where maybe it's the right thing to do. But the point is, during an artificial boom period of illusory prosperity, people are consuming their capital and they don't realize they're doing it. So, like, think back to our hypothetical owner of a 100-truck fleet. Yeah, you can imagine scenarios where maybe he doesn't want to get his oil changed and just run the trucks down so they break down, and that's the rational thing to do. But if he's doing it unaware that he's making his trucks, rendering them inoperable, and he just thinks, well, this is a great new technique I've discovered to boost profits, well, that's crazy, and he's going to regret it. So that's the Austrian story of what happens. And so at some point, how does it come to an end? How does the boom theory come to an end? At some point, typically, is because the central bank has been pumping in more and more money, prices eventually start rising so rapidly that the monetary authorities chicken out. And they say, we got to stop. We got to slow the rate of monetary inflation. And then that causes interest rates to rise. And then the jig is up, and the business owners go, oh my gosh, we should not have been expanding so rapidly. They halt, they stop dead in their tracks, start laying off workers, and then the whole thing collapses. So that's the standard story of the boom bust cycle. Okay, let me go over, I think it's the best metaphor or analogy to explain the Misesian view of what happens in a boom bust cycle is Mises' master builder analogy. And this is where I think the reason he used this story was to stress this distinction that, like I say, a lot of times, and this happened to me at NYU, when you tell that story to somebody, especially somebody who has a background more mainstream economics, that person will say, oh, so you guys are saying the problem is that the artificially low interest rates encourage overinvestment. And that's not really it. It's malinvestment. And so the way Mises illustrates that is with this analogy. So I'm going to take the analogy and I'm going to elaborate on it, talk about unemployment, things like that. But originally Mises didn't get into unemployment. So Mises was saying, imagine there's a master builder who's going to build a house, and he has a certain amount of resources at his disposal. But the thing is, he can only use the resources that are there at the site in the beginning. He can't run to Home Depot and get more. That's the way the story works. And so, of course, before embarking on this project, he needs to know, what do I have to work with? And so he surveys and figures out how many panes of glass, how many how much wood does he have? How many nails? What types of workers does he have that he can draw upon? You know, there's carpenters and just manual laborers, and there's guys who know how to lay shingles and that kind of stuff. Okay. And he's got all these other, you know, tar and so forth. Okay, great. How many bricks does he have? Great. He takes all that information into account. Then either he or his architect draws up the blueprints for a house that's going to use all these materials. And so the problem is, he thought he had 10,000 bricks to work with, but he was mistaken. He actually only has 9,000 bricks. But his blueprint assumes the use of 10,000. And so he starts building on it. You know, they dig out the ground for the foundation. They start pouring the concrete, blah, blah, blah. Boom, boom. They're building the house. And the niece's point is, it's physically impossible. They're not going to be able to finish that house the way the blueprints depict it. It's physically impossible. And when the problem happens, the crisis occurs, it would be odd to describe that and say, oh, the problem is you overinvested. And he says, no, the problem is it was malinvestment. I started a project that was too grandiose, that was too ambitious relative to the materials I actually had at my disposal. And so it's not that, oh, I built a house that was too big. That's not really quite it. It's I was building the wrong house. Okay, so let me now elaborate on that. Notice, suppose that is going on. And imagine some of the workers on the work site realize, you know, they're looking at the dwindling brick pile and they're looking at the blueprints and they're saying, hey fellas, the boss over there thinks we got 4,000 bricks left at this point, but I'm counting up and we only got like 3,000. I think originally we were off by 1,000. And so should we tell him? And what if one of the other workers says, no, don't do that, because that's just going to, you know, be such a buzzkill, right? He's going to then have to tell everyone to stop working. And, you know, just look at how happy everybody is. We're all fully employed. This is great stuff. You're just going to ruin the party if you bring up this awkward fact. So let's keep this information from the buck. We want to keep this housing boom going. And so let's go, let's get a tarp. And they get, you know, a tarp and they throw it over the brick because they don't want the boss to see. Because if he sees the dwindling brick pile, then he's going to realize something's wrong. So they want to hide that information from him. They want to trick him into continuing down this unsustainable path. Would they be doing him any favors? Of course not. If you're building the wrong house, you need to know as soon as possible, right? If the master builder learned of that mistake, that the mistake in the brick count, before they actually did anything, there'd be no harm. He would just go back to the architect and they'd redraw the blueprints, assuming 9,000 bricks. There'd be no harm at all. But once he starts construction, now he's effectively painting himself into a corner. Okay, the longer that house develops, the fewer options he has. Right? And so the worst thing would be if he learns of that discrepancy when the last brick is laid and he still has plans calling for 1,000 more and they say, guess what? We have 0 bricks left. That's the worst time for him to find out, because now how is he supposed to react to it? Now he's got to go back to the architect. I mean, they might not even, the resulting house might look ridiculous, right? They might be scrambling just to cover it up so if it rains, the inside doesn't get wet. But if he learns about it after they've just put down a few bricks, well, now he has a lot more options at his disposal. Okay? And so the point is, the longer that illusion persists, the worse it's going to be. Or conversely, the sooner the boss is apprised of the real situation, the sooner he is made aware of the real situation, the better. And it's true. What's the first thing he's going to do when someone says, whoa, 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 do you realize you're off by 1,000 on your brick count? The first thing he's going to do is pull out his bullhorn, his megaphone, and say, everybody stop working immediately. And everyone's going to stop. And then he's going to go to the architect and say, okay, here's what the house looks like now. Here's what we have left to work with. What do we do? And they're going to make the best of a bad situation. And then over time, once they figure out what to do, notice it might not be that all the workers resume at the same time. It might be some workers go back to work, but that they have to do some intermediate tasks just to get the house ready to now gradually start incorporating the other workers on this new revised blueprint. And so notice that's what happens in a market economy. When there's been an unsustainable boom period because of this faulty information provided by the artificially low interest rate, businesses are expanding and they're embarking on unsustainable projects. Then central bank chickens out, stops inflating so much, interest rates spike, give everyone the right information, the right snapshot or analysis of this is what the economy actually is like. This is really what you have to work with. And then the entrepreneurs, what do? They tell their workers to stop working, or a lot of them do. And then it's only over time, some of them shut down completely. Some of them just, you know, operate, but in a more modest pace and so on. So it takes time. A bunch of workers get laid off, and only gradually do they get reabsorbed back into the structural production. Okay, so that's not a failing of the market economy. That's exactly what we would want to happen. And that's exactly what would happen in our little hypothetical story. Okay, so did the Federal Reserve cause the Great Depression? Well, be careful in how you answer that. So here I'm the standard work here is Rothbard's American Great Depression. And then if you'll permit me to plug my own book, it's part of the Politically Incorrect Guide series. I obviously drew heavily on Rothbard, but I also incorporated a bunch of stuff. Because Rothbard just focused on the Hoover administration. He didn't get into FDR. And so I pulled that stuff in for this book. And I also dug up some historical comparisons between the 1920 and 21 depression compared to the Great Depression to show that a lot of the standard Keynesian and monetarist arguments about the Great Depression and what caused it don't really work, because those alleged causes were true even more so back in the 1920 and 21 depression, and yet a lot of people don't even know there was a depression in 1920 and 21. Okay, but for the question in hand, this is the last thing I'll talk about. I'll see if you guys have any questions for me. Did the Fed cause the Great Depression? You got to be careful. And similarly, is the Austrian claim that Ben Bernanke caused the Great Recession? And Alan Greenspan, because he was the one in charge during the housing bubble years. So yes and no. What the standard Austrian view is, let's take the Great Depression, the standard Austrian view is that the Federal Reserve had artificially low interest rates through the 1920s. That caused an unsustainable boom. And you saw that, for example, in the inflated stock market. And then that crashed in 29. And yes, there had to be a depression with a small d to correct for that. That there were too many unsustainable operations going on and they needed to stop. Workers needed to get laid off. Other resources needed to get freed up from unsustainable operations. And it would take a while for those to get reallocated into a more sustainable system of output. And it takes time. And so unemployment could have been really high for, who knows, a year, 18 months. But then the economy would have hit bottom. It would have recalibrated, and then it would have resumed growth if the government and the Fed had just minded their own business and let things sort themselves out. But that's not what happened. When the stock market crashed, Herbert Hoover came in and began a series of what at the time were unprecedented peacetime expansions of government into the economy with the aim of mitigating the fall, but which ended perpetuating the problem. And then, of course, FDR came in and just upped the ante with the New Deal. So the standard Austrian position is the Fed caused the bubble that then burst in 29. And there had to be a bad depression with a small d, but the reason it festered and lingered as what we now know of as the decade-long Great Depression is what the federal government did in response. So it's the same thing with the housing bubble. The standard Austrian view is that Alan Greenspan had artificially low interest rates. So remember, there was the dot-com boom and bust. Like the dot-com bubble was late 90s, and then it's burst. And then you also had the September 11th 2001 attacks. And so had the federal government and the Federal Reserve stood back and done nothing, there would have been a bad recession in the early 2000s, but it would have been over, and that would have been that. But instead, Greenspan cut interest rates significantly to the lowest in nominal terms that they'd been, I think, since the 1950s, I think. I have to look at that chart again, in nominal terms. And that fueled, or that was one of the contributors to the housing bubble. And so that had to crash. It was unsustainable. But if in 2007, 2008, the Fed and the federal government just stood back and let that crash happen and let major investment banks go down if need be, didn't bail anybody out and didn't slash interest rates artificially, yeah, it would have been awful. But it would have been awful for a year. The economy would have hit rock bottom. Yep, unemployment would have surged higher than it did. But then it would have come down. You would not have had, so what is it? We're now, what, 6 years into this thing and counting. And it's still an awful economy. The reason for that lingering awfulness, according to most Austrians, is the stuff the government and the Fed did in response to what would have been, or what was the inevitable downturn. Okay, so it's, so just be careful when you're telling people this. It's a two-pronged thing. On the one hand, I've seen some people have like taken my book and said, oh, Murphy showed that FDR caused the Great Depression. And well, no, that's not what I'm saying. And then a critic can easily hit me upside the head and go, you idiot. The Great Depression was already 4 years underway when Herbert, or when FDR took office. All right, so that's clearly what I'm saying. But on the other hand, to say that the Fed caused the Great Depression is also not really correct. Because you could say, well, for one thing, you could say, well, how come it didn't happen before? The Fed was formed in 1913. Why did it cause that thing and not the other one? So there's problems there. So the more correct thing, I think, is to say the Fed causes these unsustainable booms and busts, but then depending on what the government does in response, can prolong the agony. Okay, why don't I stop there? Do you guys have any questions either on this subject or anything else? We've technically got 7 minutes left. Okay, while you guys are possibly thinking, let me address, oh, you're welcome, Alexander. One, I'm kind of surprised because it's so obvious, but for what it's worth, one of the objections to this story I just told you is Paul Krugman made it, for example, is to say, well, wait a minute, you know, you Austrians, you talk about that after the crisis occurs, and businesses start laying off workers, and so you're saying workers need to reallocate from the unsustainable sectors to wherever they're supposed to be. And that's why unemployment goes up. And that's why it feels like a recession and everybody's unhappy. Okay? He said, well, during the expansion, you know, the artificial boom period, you also say that workers are being reallocated. The workers are going from where they should have been, and they're going into sectors where they shouldn't be, even though they don't know it at the time. They think they're supposed to be there at the time. And so how come unemployment doesn't go up during the boom period? Right, that's the objection. Right? So they're saying there seems to be this asymmetry, that how come workers getting shifted around in the recession feels bad and causes unemployment to go up, but your own story, you Austrian, says that the workers got reallocated improperly during the expansion. Well, the reason is, why are the workers moving? During the expansion, just to dumb it down a little bit, it's like the central bank comes in, starts lending money out at really cheap rates to all the business owners, and then the business owners enter the labor market and say, hey, whatever you're doing right now, I'll pay you 10% more. Come work for me. So that's going to lead workers to switch, but they're not going to quit their job and then stay unemployed for 6 months or more and be unemployed and get counted in the unemployment statistics and then go take this new job that's paying more. No, if you're leaving your old job, not because you're getting laid off, but because you have a better alternative, well, you're not going to be sitting in the unemployment pool for very long. And even if you are, you're going to be happy about it because you, the reason you're unemployed is because you're in between jobs because you found something better. In contrast, what happens during the bust, the reason you're switching jobs isn't because you got a better offer. It's because your first place fired you or laid you off. And so you perhaps only very reluctantly after a long search bite the bullet and go work for somebody else, even though you think that job is beneath you. So that's why, A, you're unemployed longer in the bust period than you were during the boom, and B, you're miserable about it. It's because of the nature of why are you moving. In the boom period, you're moving because you got a better offer. In the bust period, you're moving because your previous employer went out of business or had to cut back and laid you off. So that's how the Austrian story works and explains that. Like I say, it's not just Paul Krugman that said that. I think Tyler Cowen thought it was a great argument and sort of, you know, linked to it when Krugman made it. So anyway, that's the way you would handle that. Okay, well, I don't see any – thanks for the kind words, guys, who are posting the comments there. I don't see anything else. I will get the quiz questions up for this week's course and then blast out the final office hours session. And then remember, in addition to this weekly quiz, if you're taking the course for credit, then after that we'll post a longer final exam. Okay, thanks, everybody. Thanks for – tuning in, and perhaps I will see you in a future course.